On behalf of me, I'm Janet Derbyshire from the Medical Research Council in the UK, Clinical Trials Unit, and from my co-chair, Dr. Hector Perez from Buenos Aires. So our first speaker this afternoon is Dr. Bill Olson from Progenic Pharmaceutical in Tarrytown, US, who's going to present on the antiviral effects and tolerability of the CCR5 monoclonal antibody Pro-140, a proof of concept study in HIV-infected individuals. Dr. Olson.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and thanks to the organizers for the opportunity to present, and thanks to the audience members for participating this late in the conference. We appreciate that. We are very excited to be here today and describe the proof of concept study of our CCR5 monoclonal antibody, Pro-140. This study was designated 1302 and was the first to test Pro-140 in HIV-infected individuals. The study benefited from a distinguished roster of investigators, as listed here, including Mike Sagg, Jeff Jacobson, Melanie Thompson, Margaret Fischel, and the others indicated on the list here. I also wanted to note that our thoughts today are with our dear friend and colleague, Joe Stavola. Joe was the medical director for this protocol at Progenics, and Joe was recently killed in a tragic automobile accident. And today's presentation is given in honor of Joseph Stavola. I'd like to continue with an introduction to Pro-140. Pro-140 is our humanized CCR5 monoclonal antibody. It very broadly and potently inhibits CCR5-mediated HIV entry in vitro. I could spend the entire session describing how Pro-140 is different from small molecule CCR5 antagonists, such that these two, in many respects, represent distinct classes of CCR5 inhibitors. Perhaps for the purposes of today, it suffice to say that there are fundamental differences in the way in which Pro-140 and small molecule CCR5 antagonists recognize CCR5 and inhibit R5-HIV. And in many respects, these differences are very similar to the differences that one sees for nucleoside analog reverse transcriptase inhibitors and non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. A similar case where they both recognize RT in a very different manner and inhibit HIV in a very different manner. But to the matter at hand, the 1302 study was, in a sense, a classic monotherapy study. This was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study designed to evaluate the tolerability, antiviral activity, and pharmacokinetics of a single intravenous infusion of Pro-140 in HIV-infected individuals. These were individuals with easily measurable levels of virus that required CCR5 for entry. They had relatively high levels of CD4, no AIDS-defining illness, and no antiretroviral therapy for at least 3 months, consistent with the early-stage nature of the disease. A total of 39 subjects were treated with placebo or Pro-140 at the indicated dose levels. They received a single intravenous infusion and then were followed for 59 days. Individuals were followed for safety and efficacy and pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamic effects of Pro-140. Today, we'll have the opportunity to discuss antiviral effects and safety, but not PK-PD relationships. There's only so much you can fit in 10 minutes. And plus, we're going to present the PK-PD information at the upcoming ICCAC conference. That will be an oral presentation by our longtime colleague, Jeff Jacobson. And I would be remiss to upstage Jeff's presentation by discussing PK-PD today. Just stay tuned for that information, please. So this slide illustrates the baseline characteristics of the subjects. There were 9 placebo subjects and 10 in each of the Pro-140 treatment groups. Each individual received a single intravenous infusion, and each individual completed the 59-day follow-up period. In general, the study was reasonably well-balanced for a small study of this size. The median HIV RNA at entry was 27,000 copies per mil. CD4 cells averaged about 480 cells. And we were encouraged by the participation of women and minorities in this study. This slide illustrates the antiviral effects. Here we have plotted the mean log-10 change in HIV RNA as a function of time following a single intravenous infusion of placebo or Pro-140 at the indicated dose levels. So the antiviral effects were potent, prolonged, and dose-dependent. 5 mg per kg Pro-140 reduced viral loads on average by 1.7 log, or 98%, at day 10, with individual reductions ranging to 2.5 log. To our knowledge, these are the largest viral load reductions reported for just one dose of any HIV agent. Viral load reductions of about 1 log were observed at day 5 and then continued for 2 to 3 weeks post-dosing. And as you might imagine, the results were highly significant for both the 2 and the 5 mg per kg dose groups. So there are many ways to interrogate the data. Here we have plotted the mean log 10 change in HIV RNA for the different treatment groups. The blue bars represent the day 10 results from the prior slide. Of course, not every subject had a viral nadir at day 10. In some cases, it was day 12 or day 15. That's captured in the green bars. Here we have the average of the individual nadirs regardless of study day. In this case, the 5 mg per kg dose group had a 1.83 log 10 reduction. And again, we have a high degree of statistical significance for the 2 and 5 mg per kg dose groups. We also considered the percentage of subjects who responded with a greater than 10-fold reduction in HIV RNA, and that's illustrated here. Once again, we see a nice dose-response relationship with a 100% response rate at the top dose group. The slide illustrates the results of co-receptor tropism testing as performed at Monogram Biosciences. Just over 100 subjects were screened for this study. Of those, 81 had R5-only virus. That's about the right ratio for the study population. Of those, 42 were excluded for other reasons, and 39 were treated, 30 with Pro-140, 9 with placebo. While on study, a dual-mixed tropism assay result was observed in 1 of 9 placebo subjects and 1 of 30 Pro-140 subjects. The Pro-140 subject was in the low-dose group, and the dual-mixed tropism result was observed at a single day only. At all other days, including study discharge, the tropism result was R5 only. Now, I think that we as a field are just beginning to learn how to interpret data like these, but it is noteworthy that the incidence of dual-mixed tropism assay results was observed no more frequently in the Pro-140 groups than in the placebo group. And then we have initiated studies to determine, of course, whether dual-mixed viruses could be detected at baseline in these individuals. So in terms of safety, the study was relatively uneventful in terms of safety. The most commonly reported adverse events were headache and nausea, and they were reported with similar frequencies in the placebo and Pro-140 groups. Apart from that, a discussion of safety is really a discussion of what we didn't see. There were no drug-related serious adverse events, no dose-limiting toxicity, no obvious pattern of toxicity, and no signals of the type that have been reported for small molecule CCR5 antagonists, such as QTC issues, hepatotoxicity, or postural hypotension. And in addition, there was no change in plasma levels of the CC chemokine RANTES. There was, however, a trend towards increased CD4 cells in the high-dose group. This manifests itself as a 129-cell increase, or 29% increase, at day 8. And then these levels persisted for 3 weeks post-dosing. Of course, potent antiviral suppression often leads to a redistribution of CD4 cells, and that could be the case here. I think regardless of mechanism, we are encouraged by the fact that the trend is in the right direction. So just to summarize the main findings of this study, in terms of antiviral effects, we believe this study demonstrated that Pro-140 is a potent antiretroviral agent with prolonged single-dose activity, and we were encouraged by the fact that these potent antiviral effects were observed at well-tolerated doses of study drug. Next steps for Pro-140 include completing the PK/PD analyses in time for presentation at ITCAC. We have the opportunity, if we wish, to meet with FDA to discuss these findings prior to initiating additional clinical studies. And these studies could include the current intravenous formulation, as well as a new subcutaneous formulation. And I'd just like to spend a minute or two on that. We believe the feasibility of subcutaneous delivery of Pro-140 is supported by the potent and prolonged antiviral activity that we just saw, as well as the favorable solubility of Pro-140 at neutral pH and user-friendly buffers, as well as outcomes of recent 6-month animal safety studies and the bioavailability that Pro-140 demonstrated in those studies. Putting this all together, it would suggest, at least, that weekly or even every other week dosing of Pro-140 would be predicted to provide antiviral drug levels. And that's exciting to us because that means potentially subcutaneous Pro-140 would be able to provide potentially the first long-acting self-administered therapy for HIV. This would be a situation where, at least for this drug, treatment is not every day, once a day, three times a day. It's once a week or every other week, and again, self-administered by the patient. This slide just illustrates how we view Pro-140. Really, for us, the paradigm is not so much Fusion, but more other subcutaneously administered monoclonal antibodies. And here I have just listed the approved uses of the approved drugs along with a target profile for our investigational agent. So, well, like Fusion, sub-Q Pro-140 would be used subcutaneously on a chronic basis for the treatment of HIV infection. But that's where we believe the similarities and the differences become important in terms of molecular class, frequency of administration, user-friendliness of the buffer, and injection site reactions. We believe that Pro-140 stands to be quite different from Fusion and more akin to the sub-Q monoclonal antibodies. And I see the red light is beeping at me, so I'll just finish very quickly by thanking a small fraction of the many, many contributors to this program. That includes, obviously, the subjects of the 1302 study team. This is a very small list of the many contributors at Progenix. We thank our colleagues at Monogram Biosciences, and we're very grateful to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases for their continued support of Pro-140. NIAID and the Division of AIDS has supported Pro-140 at every stage of its development. And with that, I'll stop and thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Olson. I think we've got time for a few questions. So please, anyone who would like to ask a question, tell us who you are, where you come from, and please be brief so we can have as many questions as we can. I see someone at microphone two.
My name is Pietro Benazza from Switzerland. I just wonder, given the restriction to R5, whether you have thought about developing the drug as a pre-exposure prophylaxis, which would make much more sense to me.
There's been some discussion along those lines, and we are working with one group along these lines. So we're working with a group in San Diego to do this. It's not the main thrust of our program, but we recognize the potential of this drug in that setting. Thank you for that question.
I think someone's rushing up to microphone too quickly.
Yes, Ibrahim from John Hopkins, Taiwan International. I have a question that has to do with the use of monoclonal antibodies. I mean, generally speaking, we know that they are associated with TB. So what do you think of long-term using it in those patients, subgroup of patients, and probably the incidence of TB in those patients?
I'm sorry, the incidence of?
TB.
TB. Pardon me? Tuberculosis. Well, I think as a monoclonal antibody without drug-drug interactions, without any expectation that the drug would have significant drug-drug interactions, it potentially could, that would be a good application for a drug like this. Thank you for that question.
There's a question up at microphone one.
Yes. Michael Letterman, Case Western. Could you tell us a little more about the interaction of this antibody with the receptor, whether it blocks ligand receptor interactions or agonizes?
Oh, thank you for that question. That's my favorite question. So Pro-140, we have mapped the epitope for Pro-140 to elements within the amino terminal domain and the second extracellular loop. At least in vitro models, there is this window between inhibition of HIV infection and blocking the natural activity of CCR5. There's about 100-fold difference between concentrations required to block the natural activity and the concentrations required to inhibit HIV. And we'll see whether that offers some kind of advantage in man. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. I think in the, as we've got really quite tight timetable today to be ready to have the rapporteurs following on, we'll thank Dr. Olson very much for his presentation and move on to our second presentation, which is to be from Dr. Tim Jenkins, a clinician at Pfizer Global R&D at Sandwich in the UK, who's going to talk to us about the short-term monotherapy with UK453061, a novel NNRTI which reduces viral load in HIV-infected patients. Dr. Jenkins.
Thank you. It's a pleasure today to present to you the results from our study A527-1010. By way of introduction, I should say that UK453061 is a novel nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor for the treatment of HIV. Now, in preclinical studies, UK453 has shown to be active against wild-type virus and primary isolates, and also UK453 displays balanced activity against clinically significant N and RTI mutations. In vitro experiments designed to develop resistance against UK453 have shown that 2 to 3 mutations are required to obtain resistant virus, and these virus, which are now resistant to UK453, are still sensitive to efavirenz. The compound doesn't appear to inhibit CYP3A4, has a large cytotoxicity index, and is predicted to have good CNS penetration. As was shown in the poster earlier today, UK453 has shown to be safe and well tolerated at single doses up to 1.8 grams and multiple doses of 2 grams a day. That's given as 1 gram BID. The most frequent adverse events seen from the multi-dose studies have been diarrhea, abnormal bowel sounds, abdominal discomfort, flatulence, dyspepsia, and headache. And in either the single-dose studies or multiple-dose escalation studies, a maximum tolerated dose has not been identified. No significant trends in lab safety parameters were observed, and UK453 appears to have predictable PK, and there is no significant change in UK453 plasma AUC in the presence of a high fatty meal. Well, coming on to the study A527-1010, the objectives were to examine the effects of 7 days monotherapy on viral load, to see to understand the PK-PD relationships, and obviously the safety and tolerability of UK453. The patient population were HIV-infected men with no prior exposure to any NNRTI and the absence of any virus that contained NNRTI-resistant mutations. They needed CD4 counts above 250, a viral load above 5,000. They could be treatment naive, or they could be treatment experienced, but needed to be off treatment for at least 8 weeks prior to screening, and obviously they needed to be diagnosed at least 3 months prior to screening. The design of the study was that it took place as a randomized double-blind outpatient study, and it took place and occurred in 2 stages. We used modeling and simulation work to establish the correct doses to choose and also minimize patient numbers. There were 6 patients per arm, and patients were dosed for 7 days. There was then a PK day on day 8, and patients then followed up until day 40. Viral load measurements were taken at screening, randomization, and day 1 prior to dosing, and then for the days indicated on the slide. The first stage, using suspension, had doses of 10 mg BID, 30 mg BID, 100 mg BID, and 500 mg QD. And the second stage, using tablets, had doses of 100 mg QD, 750 mg QD, and 500 mg BID. A total of 81 patients were screened. We had 49 randomized. One subject actually withdrew before first dose, and so was replaced. So we had 48 patients complete the study. And as you can see here, we got the baseline characteristics of the subjects. Well, this figure is the first results figure for UK453. It's looking at the median plasma concentration of 453 versus time for day 8. UK453 PK in patients appears predictable, and the plasma concentrations of UK453 obtained in this patient study appear to be similar to levels seen in healthy volunteer studies. Here are the log 10 viral load changes from baseline to day 8 and also to nadir by dose, with the highest BID and QD doses highlighted. Doses equal to or greater than 500 mg total daily dose resulted in similar viral load reductions, with a mean decrease from baseline nadir of equal to or greater than a 1.7 log reduction. And although it's not shown on the slide here, all patients dosed with 500 mg total daily dose or greater achieved equal to or greater than a 1.5 log reduction at nadir. Here's a plot of the mean reduction of viral load per dose against time. And most doses appear to reach nadir after the last day of dosing. And again, showing that the doses above or equal to 500 mg total daily dose appear to give similar viral load reductions. As mentioned, patients were excluded if they had prior exposure to either an experimental or a marketed NNRTI or the presence of virus that contained NNRTI mutations. And during the screening of the patients, 7 out of the 81 patients screened were excluded for the presence of NNRTI mutations. All patients who were included in the study had further genotypic analysis on day 1 prior to dose, day 8 after dosing, and then at follow-up on day 40. There was one patient on 100 mg QD was observed to have a mixture of Y181Y, Y181C on day 8 only. And there were 2 patients on 750 mg QD who were found to have Y144F on day 8 only. Now, Y144F has not previously been associated with a resistance to UK453, and therefore we're examining this mutation in vitro to see if it has any effect on UK453 activity. I should also say that we have a number of crystallographic structures of HIV-RT with UK453 bound. And in fact, they'll be presented next month at the European Crystallography Meeting. Looking at these structures, UK453 bound to reverse transcriptase, Y144F appears to be located well away from actually the binding site of the compound. There are no other known NNRTI or UK453 associated resistant mutations seen in any other dose group. And also, we're currently undergoing the samples are undergoing clonal ultra-deep sequencing analysis, and the results of that will probably be presented, I guess, at ICAC. UK453 appears safe and well-tolerated in this patient population. There was one non-treatment-related serious adverse event, that was hospitalization on day 14, and 2 non-treatment-related severe AEs due to food poisoning for one individual on day 2. And there are no discontinuations due to AEs or lack of toleration. As you can see, the most common all causality AEs for 3 or more patients, which were all mild and moderate, were cold, flatulence, headache, fatigue, and nausea. And here's a table of the all causality emergent AEs occurring in more than one subject in any one treatment group. All the AEs were mild and moderate, and these AEs are similar to what we have seen and observed in healthy volunteers. So in conclusion, UK453 appears to be generally safe and well-tolerated at all doses evaluated in this study in HIV-infected men. Doses of 500 mg BID or 750 mg QD achieved a mean decrease from baseline HIV nadir values of 1.9 and 2 log, respectively. And therefore, further evaluation of QD and BID doses of UK453 for the treatment of HIV is merited. And finally, acknowledgements. And thanks. We'd like to thank all the patients who are willing to participate in this study, the investigators and staff who work so hard at each of the sites in Cologne, Frankfurt, and Hamburg. And finally, thanks to our Pfizer colleagues in Germany and Pfizer colleagues in Sandwich who discovered UK453 and have been working on its development. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jenkins. You left us plenty of time for questions, so please again tell us who you are, where you're from. Do we have any questions? Yeah, microphone one. No, microphone one is lit up, but I don't see anyone. Microphone, no.
Two.
Microphone two, there's a person and a microphone.
I'm indeed a person, John Ziegler, Sydney. Can we assume, seeing that you seem to have a very effective bioavailable liquid formulation, that children are going to be included in your clinical program?
Well, I guess the development of this compound is still very early, but I imagine once we understand that this compound is safe in long-term therapy, then those things will be under consideration.
And a second question from microphone two.
Jan van Linsen from Hamburg in Germany. What was the reason only to include men? Is there any teratogenity studies in animals? And any problem with a drug in females?
No, I mean, again, because this is a very early stage in development, we have actually in some other studies I'm not showing here in phase one studies included women. But for this study, we didn't have all the results from those toxicology studies, and some of them are still ongoing as well.
Okay, if there are no more questions, thank you again to Dr. Jenkins, and I'd like to hand over to my co-chair, Dr. Hector Perez, having given him plenty of extra time.
Thank you, Janet. Well, the next speaker is Dr. Pedro Kahn. Dr. Pedro Kahn from Westway Foundation, Buenos Aires, Argentina. And the next paper is Superior Activity of a Precitabin Compared to 3TC Over 21 Days in Treatment-Experienced HIV-1-Infected Patients Failing Therapy with M184 and NAR Residents. Thank you, Pedro.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to present this data on behalf of my co-workers in Argentina and also in Australia. ATC or abrocitabine is a citidine analog. Its triphosphate form is a potent inhibitor of HIV reverse transcriptase by chain termination. It has been shown in former studies to be active against HIV strains, including isolates carrying the M184V and other nucleoside reverse transcriptase mutations. It has shown very low toxicity, including very low mitochondrial toxicity, and it doesn't have any metabolic problems, no evident interactions with other drugs. The drug is to be administered orally, with or without food. This is a phase two randomized double-blind study, dose ranging, comparing 3TC in one arm and two different doses of ATC in treatment-experienced patients. As I said, the condition for entry was to carry the M184 mutation. Patients had to be priorly exposed to at least two different classes of antiretrovirals. They have to be failing a 3TC-containing regimen. They could also be failing FTC, but we didn't have any patient on FTC in this trial. Also, they had to show at least 2,000 copies in viral load, and any number of TAMs were allowed. We had two primary endpoints. One was the mean time weighted average change from baseline in viral load at 21 days, and the second one was the absolute change from baseline at day 21 again. So here you can see the study design. Failing patients carrying the M184V were in a blinded manner assigned either to 3TC at the standard dose or 600 milligram BID or 800 milligrams BID, and they were exposed to functional monotherapy with these drugs until day 21, when on the basis of treatment history and genotype, they were optimized and continued on study on their current arm until week 24, at which point in time all patients will be switched to open-label abrocitabine. If a patient would have failed to get at least a half a log drop in viral load by week 12, the patient will be offered to enter in an open-label follow-up. Here you can see the demographics. Most of the patients were recruited in Argentina. We had about 70% male, 30% female, and the majority of the patients had viral load below 100,000 copies. The number of TAMs were, as you can see, almost half of the population had less than three TAMs, and the other half, obviously, three or more. As you can see here, this is the time average change in viral load. Viral load was censored at date 7, 14, and 21. And as you can see, as expected, 3TC showed almost no change. And both arms showed viral load reduction starting on day 7. And the absolute change is seen in this table, in which I draw your attention to the upper line, in which you can see that, as expected, no change is seen in 3TC. And the viral load drop is 0.9 log in the 600 milligram dose and it's 0.71 log in the 800 milligram dose. This was not a pre-planned analysis, but we decided to look at those patients that had more than 3 TAMs at baseline. And as you can see here, again, no changes in the 3TC, or no significant changes in the 3TC arm. In the 600 milligram arms, the performance was quite poor, 0.37, but in the 800 milligrams arm, you can see that there was a nice reduction of 0.75 logs. What about the genotypes? Be reminded that this is a functional monotherapy with a nuke, so you wouldn't expect to be to find a lot of patients undetectable. Even so, we could only genotype 38 patients out of the 51 patients, and as you can see, all 38 patients maintained the M184B mutation during the observation period. 4 patients lost one TAM, which I think is just a matter of detection. One patient in the 3TC arm and 3 in the ATC arm. 5 patients gained one TAM at day 21. They were all on ACT, 2 in the 3TC arm and 3 in the ATC arms. No patient gained KX65R, 74V, or any other nucleoside mutation during the observation period. The drug looks pretty clean in terms of safety. As you can see, no serious adverse event. No patient had to discontinue due to adverse events. All adverse events were almost mild or moderate. And only we could identify, assessed per the investigators, one drug-related adverse event in the 3TC arm, peripheral neuropathy exacerbation, one case of mild nausea in the 600 milligram, and one case of mild dyspepsia and anorexia, in the 800 milligram arm. Regarding the severe adverse events, none of them seem to be related to study drugs. One in the 3TC arm, hypertriglyceridemia, one in the 800 milligram ATC arm, a case of thrombocytopenia that was previously established before the patient was exposed to the drug and showed up again during the study. So in conclusion, apecitabine demonstrates superior antiviral activity in patients with M184V plus minus TAMs, with a nice viral load reduction of 0.7 to 0.9 log over 21 days of functional monotherapy, and even in patients with more than 3 TAMs, 0.75 was achieved. No evidence of resistant development after 21 days of functional monotherapy. The M184B mutation was maintained in all patients with detectable virus, and we were unable to identify any new nucleoside analog mutations. Tolerability of both doses was excellent and similar to 3TC, and I can say it's maintained to date because the study is ongoing, and we expect to present the 24 weeks result early next year. I want to acknowledge all the patients and researchers participating in this study. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Pedro. The paper is open to questions. Microphone 2.
Tom Gamble from Colorado. Has this drug been studied in patients who are wild type at position 184, and if so, what is the antiviral activity with wild type 184?
Yes, we performed a study that was presented 2 years ago, and with the 600 and 800 milligram dose, we got about 1.6 logs viral load reduction in a 10 days monotherapy study.
Other questions? No. Thanks, Pedro.
Okay.
Okay. The next presentation is Dr. Christine Catalama from Sabertie Hospital, Paris, France. She will be present duet 1 and 2. 24 weeks results of the phase 3 randomized double-blind trial to evaluate the efficacy and safety of TMC-125 versus placebo in treatment-experienced HIV-1 infected patients. Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, and I would like to thank the organizer not only for selecting our abstract, but also for asking to put two abstracts on one, and also for being the last presenter of this session. I would really thank Anthony Mills, who very elegantly and gallantly lead this seat to a non-English speaking woman from Europe. So, you can see the geography of Duet 1 and Duet 2. Don't ask me the logic, because you have France in Duet 1, but you have Europe in Duet 2. You have a mix, and this northern and southern studies. So, Duet 1 and Duet 2 are two large, 600 patients per trial, randomized studies, evaluating TMC-125, 200 milligram BID versus placebo on the top of a background containing darunavir, boosted darunavir regimen with an optional enfluvitide. The primary endpoint analysis is at 24 weeks, and these are the data I'm going to present to you. The overall study period is 48 weeks with an optional 48 weeks extension you might see one day. To be eligible, the patient had to have a viral load greater than 5,000 copies and a stable therapy for 8 months. They have to be resistant to an NRTI with at least one mutation at screening or in documental history genotype. And also they have to have at least three primary PI mutation at screening. And again, and very, it was new, I mean the primary endpoint new for this design experienced patient, the primary endpoint of note was the proportion of patients achieving a viral load less than 50 copies at week 24. So here is the baseline characteristic of the patient. The majority of them were Caucasian male. The median viral load was approximately 4.8 log. The median CD4 was around 100 cells. I don't know if I have the mouse. The patients were highly experienced. Two-thirds of them had received a prior 10 to 15 antiviral drugs. 5% of them had been exposed to darunavir. They were also harboring highly resistant virus with 60% of them having greater than 2 NRTI resistance-associated mutation, and again, two-thirds having more than 4 primary mutation. Enfluvitide was used by 40% of the patient, but only de novo use in 25% of them. Despite optimization of NRTI, despite the use of the darunavir and the option to use enfluvitide, 15 to 18% of the patient had no active drugs in their background with the PSS equal 0, and a further 30% had only one active antiviral drug. So now looking to the primary endpoint, which is the viral load undetectable less than 50 copies at week 24, we see that in these experienced patients with very few treatment options, TMC-125 plus a background of boosted darunavir result in high response rate with approximately 60%. Let's go first to Duet 1, where you can see in blue that TMC-125, there was a 56% of the patient who reached viral load below 50, whereas it was 39% in the placebo group. Very similar result as seen in Duet 2, with 62% of undetectability below 50 copies compared to 44%. The high proportion of responders in the placebo group is due probably to the almost universal use of darinavir de novo. And in fact, the virological response who is achieved here is very comparable to what has been reported with darinavir in the POWER studies. Now, if we look to a slightly less stringent criteria of less than 400 copies, you can see that the results are even much better, with 74% of the patient below detection compared to 51% in DUET 1 and 75% again below 400 copies compared to 54 in DUET 2. These differences are also highly significant. Now, if we look to the viral reduction in those two trials from baseline to week 24, you can see that a very nice reduction is achieved with less than minus 2.4 logs in the TMC 125 group in DUET 1 compared to 1.7 in the placebo group. These are very similar in DUET 2 with a 2.3 log reduction in the TMC 125 group compared to 1.7 in the placebo group. Now, if we look to the change in CD4 cell count from baseline, again in DUET 2, there is an increase of plus 89 CD4 compared to 64 in the placebo group. The difference is statistically significant. And please note that it represents from baseline an 80% increase, which means clinically a lot in those patients who were around 100 CD4. In DUET 2, there was also a greater increase in CD4 in the TMC 125 group with plus 78 compared to 66 in the placebo group. But here, the results did not reach statistical significance. The reason why there is a difference in the two studies yet unclear, but we might also think that the recovery of CD4 is slow in some patients, and with an extended follow-up, there might be a bigger difference. So now moving on to looking at the response of TMC 125, again, below 50 copies, according to the number of the active background drug, you can see that in case with of no active drugs, I cannot see here. In case of very few active drug here, it's here that there is the best advantage of TMC 125 with 47% reaching undetectability below 50 copies compared to 9% in the placebo group. The difference were also very high in case of having only one drug. As soon as you have two or more than, or three or more drugs, TMC 125 performed better, but the difference was less. This really suggests that once you have two fully active drugs, probably a third one is adding little benefit. And very similar results I've seen in DUET 2 before. Again, 44% of the patients with no active background reach undetectable level compared to 7% in the placebo group. And you can see all over the stratum very similar results. Now, the primary analysis of this trial divided the patient according to the inferiority use. And again, I'm sorry, this is slightly complicated, but not that much. You have on the left side the patient who either reused anfurvetide or were not using anfurvetide, And on the right side, the ones who are using Amfivatide de novo. And as you can see here, there is a much higher benefit in those who are reusing or not using Amfivatide of TM3-125, with 55% of the patient who reaching below 50 copies compared to only 33% in the placebo group. Slightly in contrast, in those who used on top of TMC, darunavir, and amfivatide de novo, the difference with the placebo group was less pronounced. And you have exactly similar results in DUET 2 with rather this very nice activity. So now, what is the virological response according to baseline mutation? 13 baseline resistance mutations have been associated with decreased response to TMC-125, that will be called TMC-125-RA. And you can see the list, 90, 136. Importantly, you can see that there is not the K103N that even as clinical person we know, which is very frequent in our NNRTI-resistance patients. So now when we look to the response, the virological response according to the number of mutation, you can see that in the absence of any of these 13 mutations, but which may include other NNRTI mutations, you have a nearly 80% of antiviral response. One mutation, 60. One and two mutations, 60. It's only after three and more mutations that there is a decreased response to TMC-125. But of note, and very importantly, in all this big number of patients, it was only 14% of these who had three or more TMC-125. So this situation is very infrequent in the clinics. So now we wanted to see the effect of one particular mutation, the Y181C on the TMC-125 response. So this is a very common mutation which confer a higher level of resistance to currently available NNRTI. And if you can see here, the blue bar represent the overall response to TMC-125. And this bar here show you that when there is the Y181C alone, there is still a 60% of virological response. When the 181, this mutation is with one, nearly 60. And it's only when there is three or four mutations in addition to the Y181C that there is a decreased efficacy. But again, this is a very infrequent situation in the clinics, which concern, in these particular trials, only 13% of the people. Overall, the adverse event profile in the TFC group were very similar to the placebo. I have just highlighted the most important data. You can see that discontinuation due to adverse events were very infrequent, about 5%. There was rash, and I will come back to that. And importantly, the nervous system disorder or psychiatric disorder were seen with a similar frequency or even lower in the TMC-125 group compared to the placebo. And this is very notable that these type of adverse effects are known to be associated with the use of NNRTI. So back to the rash, the overall incidence was 17% in the TMC-125 group and 9% in the placebo group. It occurs most frequently, as usual, in the second week of therapy. This was very mild, usually mild to moderate, with 1% grade 3 and 0% grade 4. Very importantly, there was no Steven Johnson, no erythema multiforme, no severe things. And this led to a very infrequent discontinuation of the treatment, mostly self-limiting despite continuation of treatment. There was a higher incidence of rash in women, but there was no association with an increased severity, no treatment discontinuation. Neither was association between rash and baseline CD4 count. And again, very important in the clinics, in patients with a history of an NRTI-related rash, there was no apparent increase. So now moving to the incidence of grade 3 or 4 laboratory abnormalities, including the lipids and the liver parameters, that was generally similar between TMC-125 and placebo, and really no other clinically relevant abnormalities. So, in conclusion, from these very large, double-blind, randomized controlled trials, 2AT1 and 2, we've seen that TMC-125 consistently demonstrates superiority over placebo in those treatment-experienced patients, including those with an NRTI-resistant virus, with 56% of DUET-1 patients and 62% in DUET-2 of the patient achieving a viral load suppression less than 50 in a context of a background that includes darinavir. Even in the absence of any other fully active background regimen, over 40% of the patients with TMC-125 achieve this undetectability, which is the goal of the treatment. 13 TMC-125 resistance-associated mutations were identified, but in the presence of 0, 1, or even 2 of these mutations, there was still a virological response greater than the overall placebo. And, of note again, these three mutations were infrequent since it affected only less than 15% of the patient. With regard to the tolerance of the drug, except for the rash, the incidence and severity of adverse events were really similar to the placebo. So I think we can really see TMC-125 following these phase 3 studies and realize that this drug has the ability to extend and enhance the NNRTI class, which was we need in the clinics, and provide really a new treatment option for patients with resistance to or unable to tolerate other NNRTIs. And I will like to end by thanking, but very deeply thanking, all the people, all the investigators, and behind each investigator, all the clinical person, the nurses who have been extensively working to put this presentation in 10 minutes, DUET-1 and DUET-2. I would also like to thank the Tibotec people for their very scientific knowledge, and thank you to be there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ketrama. Microphone 2.
Couple of questions, Christine. Congratulations for the presentation. The first was, did you detect any case of rash that was associated with fever or with liver toxicity, or all the cases was just skin involvement exclusively?
The case were very usually macular rash that disappeared. Very quickly. There was no, I mean, the case you mentioned are grade 3 or 4, and there was only one grade 3. So really, it's not neither in the case of light test sensitivity, there was no thin case. I think, and again, you know, José, that I'm not having the 1,200 patient data in my thing. I think we may, for maybe more sure, ask to Brian Woodford, who knows even better than me the So do there were any of the rash associated with fever and hepatic transaminase?
So 1% of subjects had grade 3 rash, but only 2 of the subjects were associated with rash with fever, and there were no associations with increased liver transaminases in association with rash.
So it's only 2 out of more than 600 patients.
No, the second question is, Christine, when you related the degree of response with baseline mutations, did you consider only those mutations who were actually present at baseline, or you consider also those mutations who were archived and who were detected before starting the trial?
I think it was considered the mutation that was present at screening and baseline, but for being enrolled and screened, you have to have mutation. But there was no, I mean, it could not be taken into consideration the mutation they have in the past.
So
is that
only,
correct, Mark?
It was only those actually present at baseline, not those that might have been detected in the past but had disappeared
no, because
at the moment.
There was no centralization of that data, you know?
Okay, thank you.
Michael from two.
Christine, beautiful studies, great results.
Thanks.
I just don't understand how you come to the conclusion based on the data presented that the Y181C mutation does not compromise the virological response, because I don't think you can say that based on what you presented.
Oh, sorry, Yupi, if I have not been clear. It was a little fast, 10 minutes to give all the things included in the studies. But I didn't mean that Y181C was not affecting, but per se, when this mutation was a lot, there was no decreased activity, neither with one or two. It's only when it's associated with more than two, these Y181C, that there was a decrease.
No, I think you were clear in stating that, but the comparator was actually all patients, correct? Or was it the patients without...
Okay.
Without one...
I was sure that somebody would ask this excellent question, so... I think I had the answer. So there was, the comparator was not the overall group, but the patient who had no NNRTI mutation.
Okay.
Okay?
Clear.
So it's...
No, then now I understand. Thanks.
Okay, I'm sure you're quick.
One question more in the microphone one.
Trip Gulick from New York. Christine, thanks for the presentation. The results certainly are impressive, but why do you think the people with a baseline PSS of 3 did no better than the groups with a PSS of 2? And wouldn't we like to see even higher response rates below 50 as we add additional active drugs?
First, consider it's less than 50 at week 24. I'm sure you do not capture all the entire. I know I've, you know, patient enrolled with, you know, really very high viral. You cannot expect there are less than 50. So maybe over time this will be changed. This is the first part of the response. Otherwise, I would say that, you know, when you add many and several pathogens and realize that the placebo, the control group, is darunavir. And when you have specifically darunavir anti-20 in the very highly resistant patient, because, you know, T20 was not randomized. So it's always, most of the time, given in the most severely affected patient. And in that case, at 24 weeks, you don't see anything expressed. it would be nice to go in sub-analysis and to see if this population is not the one with the highest number of resistance mutation. But I think the simple message we can keep in the clinic is that when you have already two strong agents, 114 and 125, for most of the case, even if no active background, it's already given a very, very excellent response, less than 50 copies.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Christine. Thanks, Janet, and the speakers. The closing ceremony is coming.